Christmas, 1944. Good Odango has pointed Wing out to Lieutenant Maury and Maury's guard troops and made it clear that they are not to run their bayonets through Wing's torso and wiggle the blades around in his vitals unless there is some exceptionally good reason, such as suppressing all-out rebellion. The same qualities that make Wing valuable to Good Odango make him the most likely leader of any organized breakout attempt. As soon as the general and his aide have departed from Boondock, Good Odango goes and finds Wing, who is supervising the boring of the diagonal shaft towards Lake Yamamoto. He is one of those lead-by-example types, and so he is way up at the rock face, working a drill, at the end of a few hundred meters of tunnel so narrow that it has to be negotiated on hands and knees. Good Odango has to present himself at the Golgotha end of the tunnel and send a messenger crawling up into it, wearing a rusty helmet to protect himself from the shattered stone that drizzles down from the rock face. Wing appears 15 minutes later, black from the rock dust that is condensed onto his sweaty skin, red where the skin has been abraded or slashed by stone. He devotes a few minutes to methodically hawking dust up out of his lungs. Every so often he rolls his tongue like a pea shooter and fires a jet of phlegm against the wall and clinically observes it run down the stone. Good Odango stands by politely. These Chinese have an entire medical belief system centering on phlegm, and working in the mines gives them a lot to talk about.
"Ventilation not good?"
Good Odango says. Whorehouse Shanghainese has not equipped him with certain technical terms like ventilation, so Wing has taught him the vocabulary. Wing grimaces.
"I want to finish tunnel. I do not want to sink more ventilation shaft. Waste of time."
The only way to keep the workers at the rock face from suffocating is by sinking vertical air shafts from the surface down to the diagonal shaft at intervals. They have devoted as much effort to these as they have to the diagonal itself. And we're hoping they'd never have to dig another.
"How much farther?"
Good Odango asks, as Wing finishes another paroxysm. Wing looks thoughtfully at the ceiling. He has Golgotha mapped out in his head better than its designer does.
50 meters.
The designer cannot help grinning.
"Is that all? Excellent.
We go fast now,"
Wing says proudly, his teeth gleaming for a moment in the lamplight. Then he seems to remember that he is a slave laborer in a death camp, and the teeth disappear.
"We can go faster if we dig in straight line."
Wing is alluding to the fact that the tunnel to Lake Yamamoto is laid out in blueprints as a diagonal. But Good Odango, without changing the blueprints, has ordered that it actually be dug with bends. These bends increase the length of the tunnel by quite a bit. Furthermore, the rubble tends to pile up in the flatter western section and must be raked along by hand. The only people who know about the existence of these bends are him, Wing, and Wing's crew. The only person who understands the true reason for their existence is Good Odango.
"Do not dig in a straight line. Keep digging, as I said."
"Yes."
"Also, you will need a new ventilation shaft."
"More ventilation shaft? No!"
Wing protests. The ventilation shafts, shown on the plans, awkward zigzags and all, are bad enough. But Good Odango has several times told Wing and his crew to begin work on some additional ventilation shafts before changing his mind and telling them to abandon the work.
"These new ventilation shafts will be dug from the top down," says Good Odango.
"No,"
says Wing, still completely flabbergasted. This is utter madness, in that if you dig a vertical shaft from the top downwards, you have to haul the rubble up out of the hole. If you do it the other way, the rubble falls down and can be easily disposed of.
"You will get new helpers, Filipino workers."
Wing looks stunned. He is even more cut off from the world than Good Odango. He must infer the progress of the war from maddeningly oblique hints. He and his workers fit the crazily scattered evidence at their disposal into elaborate theories. These theories are all so wildly wrong that Good Odango would laugh out loud at them, if not for the fact that he is sympathetic. Neither he nor Captain Noda knew that MacArthur had landed on Leyte, or that the Imperial Navy had been crushed until the General told them. One thing that Wing and his men have got right is that Boondock employs imported labor in order to ensure secrecy. If any of the Chinese workers do manage to escape, they will find themselves on an island far from home among people who do not speak their language and who do not especially like them. The fact that Filipino workers will soon be arriving give them a lot to think about. They will be up all night whispering to each other, trying to reconstruct their theories.
"We don't need new workers. We are almost done," Wing says,
his pride hurt again. Goto Dango taps himself on both shoulders with both index fingers, suggesting epaulets. It takes Wing only an instant to realize that he's talking about the General, and then a profoundly conspiratorial look comes over his face and he takes half a step closer.
"Orders," Goto Dango says. "We dig lots of ventilation shafts now."
Wing was not a miner when he arrived at Boondock, but he is now. He is baffled, as he should be.
"Ventilation shafts? To where?"
"To nowhere,"
Goto Dango says. Wing's face is still blank. He thinks Goto Dango's bad Shanghainese is preventing understanding, but Goto Dango knows that Wing will figure it out soon. Some night during the bad, fretful moments that always come just before sleep. And then he will lead the rebellion, and Lieutenant Maury's men will be ready for it. They will open fire with their mortars. They will detonate the mines, use the machine guns, sweeping across their carefully plotted interlocking fields of fire. None of them will survive. Goto Dango doesn't want that, so he reaches out and slaps Wing on the shoulder.
"I will give you instructions. We will make a special shaft."
Then he turns around and leaves. He has surveying to do. He knows that Wing will put it all together in time to save himself. Filipino prisoners arrive, in columns that have degenerated into ragged skeins, shuffling on bare feet, leaving a wet red trail up the road. They are prodded onwards by the boots and bayonets of Nipponese army troops, who look almost as wretched. When Goto Dango sees them staggering into the camp, he realizes that they must have been on their feet continuously since the order was given by the General 2 days ago. The General promised 500 new workers. Slightly fewer than 300 actually arrive, and from the fact that none of them is being carried on stretchers, a statistical impossibility given their average physical condition, Goto Dango assumes that the other 200 must have stumbled or passed out en route and been executed where they hit the ground. Boondock is eerily well-stocked with fuel and rations, and he sees to it that the prisoners and the army troops alike are well-fed and given a day of rest. Then he puts them to work. Goto Dango has been commanding men long enough now that he picks out the good ones right away. There is a toothless, pop-eyed character named Rodolfo with iron gray hair and a big cyst on his cheek, arms that are too long, hands like grappling hooks, and splay-toed feet that remind him of the natives he lived with on New Guinea. His eyes are no particular color. They seem to have been put together from shards of other people's eyes. Scintillas of gray, blue, hazel, and black, all sintered together. Rodolfo is self-conscious about his lack of teeth and always holds one of his sprawling, prehensile paws over his mouth when he speaks. Whenever Goto Dango or another authority figure comes nearby, all of the young Filipino men avert their gaze and look significantly at Rodolfo, who steps forward, covers his mouth, and fixes his weird, alarming stare upon the visitor.
"Form your men into half a dozen squads and give each squad a name and a leader. Make sure each man knows the name of his squad and of his leader,"
Goto Dango says rather loudly. At least some of the other Filipinos must speak English. Then he bends closer and says quietly,
"Keep a few of the best and strongest men for yourself."
Rodolfo blinks, stiffens, steps back, removes his hand from his mouth, and uses it to snap out a salute. His hand is like an awning that throws a shadow over his entire face and chest. It is obvious that he has learned to salute from Americans. He turns on his heel.
Rodolfo.
Rodolfo turns around again, looking so irritated that Goto Dengo must stifle a laugh.
MacArthur is on Leyte.
Rodolfo's chest inflates like a weather balloon, and he gains about 3 inches in height, but the expression on his face does not change. The news ramifies through the Filipino camp like lightning seeking the ground. The tactic has the desired effect of giving the Filipinos a reason to live again. They suddenly display great energy and verve. A supply of badly worn drills and air compressors has arrived on Carabao-drawn carts, evidently brought in from one of the other boondock-like sites around Luzon. The Filipinos, experts at internal combustion, cannibalize some compressors to fix others. Meanwhile, the drills are passed around to Rodolfo's squads, who drag them up onto the top of the ridge between the rivers and begin sinking the new ventilation shafts, while Wing's Chinese men put the last touches on the Golgotha complex below. The carts that brought in the equipment were simply grabbed off the roads by the Nipponese army, along with their drivers, mostly farm boys, and pressed into service on the spot. The farm boys can never leave Boondock, of course. The weaker Carabaos are slaughtered for meat. The stronger ones put to work on Golgotha, and the drivers are assimilated into the workforce. One of these is a boy named Juan, with a big round head and a distinctly Chinese cast to his features. He turns out to be trilingual. He can communicate in a sort of pidgin with Wing and the other Chinese, frequently by using a finger to draw Chinese characters on the palm of his hand. Juan is small, healthy, and has a kind of wary agility that Goto Dengo thinks may be useful in what is to come, and so he becomes one of the special crew. The submerged plumbing in Lake Yamamoto needs to be inspected. Goto Dengo has Rodolfo ask around and see if there are any men among them who have worked as pearl divers. He quickly finds one, a lithe, frail-looking fellow from Palawan named Augustin. Augustin is weak from dysentery, but he seems to perk up around water and, after a couple of days' rest, is diving down to the bottom of Lake Yamamoto with no trouble. He becomes another of Rodolfo's picked men. There are really too many Filipinos for the number of tools and holes that they have available, and so the work goes quickly at first, as fresh men are quickly rotated through by the squad leaders. Then, one night at about 2 in the morning, an unfamiliar sound reverberates through the jungle, filtering up from the lowlands where the Tojo River meanders through cane fields and rice paddies. It is the sound of vehicles, masses of them. Since the Nipponese have been out of fuel for months, Goto Dengo's first thought is that it must be MacArthur. He throws on a uniform and runs down to Boondock's main gate along with the other officers. Dozens of trucks and a few automobiles are queued up there, engines running, headlights off. When he hears a Nipponese voice coming from the lead car, his heart sinks. He long ago stopped feeling bad about wanting to be rescued by General Douglas MacArthur. Many soldiers ride atop the trucks. When the sun rises, Goto Dengo savors the novel and curious sight of fresh, healthy, well-fed Nipponese men. They are armed with light and heavy machine guns. They look like Nipponese soldiers did way back in 1937, when they were rolling across northern China. It gives Goto Dengo a strange feeling of nostalgia to remember a day when a terrible defeat was not imminent, when they were not going to lose everything horribly. A lump actually gathers in his throat, and his nose begins to run. Then he snaps out of it, realizing that the big day has finally arrived. The part of him that is still a loyal soldier of the Emperor has a duty to see that the vital war material, which has just arrived, is stored away in the big vault of Golgotha. The part of him that isn't a loyal soldier anymore still has a lot to accomplish. In war, no matter how much you plan and prepare and practice, when the big day actually arrives, you still can't find your ass with both hands. This day is no exception. But after a few hours of chaos, things get straightened out, people learn their roles. The heavier trucks cannot make it up the rough road that Goto Dengo's had built up the stream bed of the Tojo River, but a couple of the small ones can, and these become the shuttles. So the big trucks pull, one by one, into a heavily fenced and guarded area, well sheltered from MacArthur's observation planes, that was built months ago. Filipinos swarm into these trucks and unload crates, which are small but evidently quite heavy. Meanwhile, the smaller trucks shuttle the crates up the Tojo River Road to the entrance of Golgotha, where they are unloaded onto handcars and rolled into the tunnel to the main vault. As per the instructions handed down from on high, Goto Dango sees to it that every 20th crate is diverted to the Fool's Chamber. The unloading proceeds automatically from there, and Goto Dango devotes most of these days to supervising the final stages of the digging. The new ventilation shafts are proceeding on schedule, and he only needs to check them once a day. The diagonal is now only a few meters away from the bottom of Lake Yamamoto. Groundwater has begun to seep through small cracks in the bedrock and trickle down the diagonal into Golgotha, where it collects in a sump that drains into the Tojo. Another few meters of cutting, and they will break through into the short stub tunnel that Wing and his men created many months ago, digging downwards from what later became the bottom of the lake. Wing himself is otherwise engaged these days. He and Rodolfo and their special crew are completing final preparations. Rodolfo and company are digging down from the top of the ridge, cutting what looks like just another vertical ventilation shaft. Wing and company are directly below, engaged in a complicated subterranean plumbing project. Goto Dango has entirely lost track of what day it is. About 4 days after the trucks come, though, he gets a clue. The Filipinos spontaneously break into song over their evening rice bowls. Goto Dango recognizes the tune vaguely. He occasionally heard the American Marines singing it in Shanghai. What child is this who laid to rest on Mary's lap is sleeping? The Filipinos sing that and other songs in English and Spanish and Latin all evening long. After they get their lungs unlimbered, they sing astonishingly well, occasionally breaking into two- and three-part harmony. At first, Lieutenant Maury's guards get itchy trigger fingers, thinking it's some kind of a signal for a mass breakout. Goto Dango doesn't want to see his work cut short by a massacre, and so he explains to them that it is a religious thing, a peaceful celebration. That night, another midnight truck convoy arrives, and the workers are rousted to unload it. They work cheerfully, singing Christmas carols and making jokes about Santa Claus. The whole camp stays up well past sunrise unloading trucks. Boondock has gradually become a nocturnal place anyway, to avoid the gaze of observation planes. Goto Dango is just thinking of hitting the sack when a fusillade of sharp crackling noises breaks out above the camp on the Tojo River. Ammunition being in short supply, hardly anyone actually fires guns anymore, and he almost doesn't recognize the sound of the Nambu. Then he jumps onto the running board of a truck and tells the driver to head upstream. The shooting has died down as suddenly as it started. Beneath the bald tires of the truck, the river is turned opaque and bright red. About 24 corpses lie in the water before the entrance to Golgotha. Nipponese soldiers stand around them, up to their calves in the red water, their weapons slung from their shoulders. A sergeant is going around with a bayonet, stirring the guts of the Filipinos who are still moving.
"What is going on?"
Goto Dango says. No one answers, but no one shoots him either. He will be allowed to figure it out himself. The workers had clearly been unloading another small truck, which is still parked there at the head of the road. Resting beneath its tailgate is a wooden crate that was apparently dropped. Its heavy contents have exploded the crate and spilled across the uneven conglomerate of river rocks, poured concrete, and mine tailings that make up the riverbed here. Goto Dango sloshes up to it and looks. He sees it clearly enough, but he can't somehow absorb the knowledge until he feels it in his hands. He bends down, wraps his fingers around a cold brick on the bottom of the river, and heaves it up out of the water. It is a glossy ingot of yellow metal, incredibly heavy, stamped with words in English, Bank of Singapore. There is a scuffle behind him. The sergeant stands at the ready as two of his men jerk the Filipino driver out of the cab of his truck that Goto Dango rode in on. Calmly, looking almost bored, the sergeant bayonets the driver. The men drop him in the red water and he disappears.
"Merry Christmas!" one of the soldiers cracks.
Everyone laughs, except for Goto Dango.